Welcome. We are back in chapter 16, The Integral Knowledge and the Aim of Life, Four Theories of Existence. And last week, we had got to have a look at what he proposes as the supracosmic view of things, which is that the supreme reality is alone real. If there is a universe at all, it is dependent, contingent upon this, and all things are absorbed back into that. If there is an individual, then that little point is dissolved back into the vast map of this transcendent reality and disappears into it. There is no persistent individuality, and the cosmos is itself only as real as that transcendent reality allows it to be. Sri Aurobindo posed the question that in the individual which insists on perfection, which insists on transcendence of its temporality and its suffering, cannot be a mere imposture of being as expressed in the individual, and that the extinction of the individual should be the final end of it. No, that it insists that it is and that it aspires to be more is a sign that its meaning is greater. So he is done for the moment with the supracosmic view, and tonight we take up two of the other remaining views, the cosmic terrestrial and the supraterrestrial. He begins, the cosmic terrestrial view, which we may take next as the exact opposite of the supracosmic, considers cosmic existence as real. It goes farther and accepts it as the only reality, and its view is confined ordinarily to life in the material universe. So if the supracosmic says that only the transcendent being is real and the cosmic doesn't count, this turns it around and says, no, only the cosmic counts, and that's it. God, if God exists, is an eternal becoming. Or if God does not exist, then nature, whatever view we may take of nature, whether we regard it as a play of force with matter, or a great cosmic life, or even admit a universal impersonal mind in life and matter, is a perennial becoming. So in other words, becoming is the root of things, whether we espouse materialism, saying that only matter is real, if we espouse vitalism, saying that life is what drives matter and that is the primary reality, or if we say no, all is an image seen within the cosmic mind. So in other words, the views of materialism, vitalism, and idealism as reflected in Locke, Bergson, and Berkeley all rely on this common theme that the universe is essentially a field of becoming. This may also have play in the 20th century in Théodore de Chardin's philosophy of evolution, where if there is Godhead, it emerges in time with the evolution of consciousness through material forms. Earth is the field, he writes, or it is one of the temporary fields. Man is the highest possible form, or only one of the temporary forms of the becoming. Man individually, maybe altogether mortal. Mankind also may survive only for a certain short period of the Earth's existence. Earth itself may bear life only for a rather longer period of its duration in the solar system. That system may itself one day come to an end, or at least cease to be an active or productive factor in the becoming. The universe we live in may itself dissolve or contract again into the seed state of its energy, but the principle of becoming is eternal, or at least as eternal as anything can be in the obscure ambiguity of existence. It is indeed possible to suppose a persistence of man, the individual, as a psychic entity in time, a continuous terrestrial or cosmic ensouling or reincarnation without any afterlife or other life elsewhere. In that case, one may either suppose an ideal of constantly increasing perfection or approach to perfection, or a growth towards an enduring felicity somewhere in the universe as the aim of this endless becoming. But in an extreme terrestrial view, this is with difficulty tenable. Certain speculations of human thought have tended in this direction, but they have not taken a substantial body. A perpetual persistence in the becoming is usually associated with the acceptance of a greater supra-terrestrial existence. So, if we take this last part of this paragraph, we see that this is a matches closely with what we could call current pop cosmology. He doesn't deny later in the paragraph that the individual might have a psychic persistence, but this view would restrict it to the confines of the universal becoming. How can you maintain that position is why he says this is with difficulty tenable. Usually, if you're going to suggest that there is a persistent, recurrent soul that incarnates again and again in a substantial physical body, that it has to be associated with some larger supra-terrestrial existence. In other words, it must come from a beyond and then inhabit this body. But he'll get to that momentarily. So he continues here. In the ordinary view of a soul terrestrial life or a restricted transient passage in the material universe, for possibly there may be thinking, living beings and other planets, an acceptance of man's mortality and a passive endurance of it, or an active dealing with a limited personal or collective life and life aims, are the only choice possible. The one high and reasonable course for the individual human being, unless indeed he is satisfied with pursuing his personal purposes or somehow living his life until it passes out of him, is to study the laws of becoming and take the best advantage of them to realize, rationally or intuitionally, inwardly or in the dynamism of life, its potentialities in himself or for himself, or in or for the race of which he is a member. His business is to make the most of such actualities as exist, and to seize on or to advance towards the highest possibilities that can be developed here or are in the making. Only mankind as a whole can do this with entire effect, by the mass of individual and collective action, in the process of time, in the evolution of the race experience. But the individual man can help towards it in his own limits, can do all these things for himself to a certain extent in the brief space of life allotted to him. But especially, his thought and action can be a contribution towards the present intellectual, moral, and vital welfare and the future progress of the race. So, the human must study the laws of the universe as it is an endless becoming. Derive what he may from those studies, ingest them, address them, enjoy so far as he can a life within this construct. But the individual is a smaller thing, but can yet serve meaningfully in the collective advance. The individual he writes about here, he is capable of a certain nobility of being, an acceptance of his inevitable and early individual annihilation does not preclude him from making a high use of the will and thought which have been developed in him, or from directing them to great ends which shall or may be worked out by humanity. This is an echo of Greek philosophy, and Sri Aurobindo would have been quite familiar with both the Sophists and with Plato in the Greek. Even the temporary character of the collective being of humanity does not so very much matter, except in the most materialist view of existence. For so long as the universal becoming takes the form of human body and mind, the thought, the will it has developed in its human creature, will work itself out, and to follow that intelligently is the natural law and best rule of human life. So however you may scan this, this is by far a better brand of materialism than what we typically see now. Humanity and its welfare progress during its persistence on Earth, provide the largest field and the natural limits for the terrestrial aim of our being. The superior persistence of the race and the greatness and importance of the collective life should determine the nature and scope of our ideals. But if the progress or welfare of humanity be excluded as not our business or as a delusion, the individual is there to achieve his greatest possible perfection or make the most of his life in whatever way his nature demands will then be life's significance. So the advance of the race first is the noblest, and then, if not that, then the individual may chip away at things as best he can and advance and enjoy according to his strength. So this is the restricted view of this cosmic terrestrial existence. He moves on. The supra-terrestrial view admits the reality of the material cosmos, and it accepts the temporary duration of Earth and human life as the first fact we have to start from. But it adds to it a perception of other worlds or planes of existence which have an eternal, or at least a more permanent duration. It perceives behind the mortality of the bodily life of man the immortality of the soul within him. So, cosmos is real, but there are other worlds to which the soul can gain access. A belief in the immortality, the eternal persistence of the individual human spirit apart from the body, is the key word of this conception of life. So the important thing is the immortality of the human spirit here. The accent is off the cosmos and on what dwells inside the human, that is to say, the soul. That of itself necessitates its other belief in higher planes of existence than the material or terrestrial, since for a disembodied spirit there can be no abiding place in a world whose every operation depends upon some play of force, whether spiritual, mental, vital, or material, in and with the forms of matter. There arises from this view of things the idea that the true home of man is beyond, and that the earth life is in some way or other only an episode of his immortality, or a deviation from a celestial and spiritual into a material existence. But what then is the character, the origin, and the end of this deviation? There is first the idea of certain religions, long persistent but now greatly shaken or discredited, that man is a being primarily created as a material living body upon earth, into which a newly born divine soul is breathed, or else with which it is associated by the fiat of an almighty creator. He's referring evidently to the theism of the Middle East in all three of its branches, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. A solitary episode, this life is his one opportunity from which he departs to a world of eternal bliss or to a world of eternal misery, either according as the general or preponderant balance of his acts is good or evil, or according as he accepts or rejects, knows or ignores a particular creed, mode of worship, divine mediator, or else according to the arbitrary predestining caprice of his creator. I like that the idea of predestination has been brought in here. But that is the supra-terrestrial theory of life in its least rational form of questionable creed or dogma. Taking the idea of the creation of a soul by the physical birth as our starting point, we may still suppose that by a natural law common to all, the rest of its existence has to be pursued beyond, in a supra-terrestrial plane, when the soul has shaken off from it its original matrix of matter, like a butterfly escaped from the chrysalis and disporting itself in the air on its light and colored wings. Or we may suppose, preferably, a pre-terrestrial existence of the soul, a fall or descent into matter, and a reascension into celestial being. If we admit the soul's pre-existence, there is no reason to exclude this last possibility as an occasional spiritual occurrence. A being belonging to another plane of existence may conceivably assume for some purpose the human body and nature. But this is not likely to be the universal principle of earth existence or a sufficient rationale for the creation of the material universe. Remember, his consideration in this chapter is to look at the theories of existence. the individual exists within the cosmic context. How is it, why is it that the world manifests, that the universe as a whole is here? This is what he's trying to justify, and not the occasional visit of a spirit who's somewhat curious and interested, will descend in, dip into matter, stay for a bit of time, and then depart. Not good enough reason to manifest a cosmos, he says. This goes farther. It is also sometimes supposed that the solitary life on Earth is a stage only, and the development of the being nearer to its original glory occurs in a succession of worlds, which are so many other stages of its growth, stadia of its journey. Now, this has echoes even in Christianity. Irenaeus, one of the great founding Orthodox fathers of that faith, had this idea that after leaving the earth, there are a series of other worlds through which one grows to get to heaven. Back to Sri Aurobindo. The material universe, or earth especially, will then be a sumptuously appointed field created by a divine power, wisdom, or caprice for the enacting of this interlude. According to the view we choose to take of the matter, we shall see in it a place of ordeal, a field of development, or a scene of spiritual fall and exile. There is, too, an Indian view, which regards the world as a garden of the divine lila, a play of the divine being with the conditions of cosmic existence in this world of an inferior nature. The soul of man takes part in the lila through a protracted series of births, but it is destined to reascend at last into the proper plane of the divine being and there enjoy an eternal proximity and communion. This gives a certain rationale to the creative process and the spiritual adventure, which is either absent or not clearly indicated in the other accounts of this kind of soul movement or soul cycle. Yes, you can contrast this, for instance, with the Gnostic tendency in Near Eastern and Western mysticism, which is otherworldly, but which sees the world as primarily a field of suffering and falsity, which one has to escape from and get beyond even the false God back to the true God who is beyond the universe and who did not create this universe that we suffer and experience. So this idea of lila is quite different from that. Far more positive note, but still the soul gains access to the superior world beyond and leaves the relative bliss of experience on the earth to a more pleasurable and delightful existence in the super-terrestrial home from which we came. Back to this. Always, there are three essential characteristics in all these varying statements of the common principle. First, the belief in the individual immortality of the human spirit. Secondly, as a necessary consequence, the idea of its sojourn on earth as a temporary passage or a departure from the highest eternal nature and of a heaven beyond as its proper habitation. Thirdly, an emphasis on the development of the ethical and spiritual being as the means of ascension, and therefore the one proper business of life in this world of matter. So individual immortality, the temporary passage which this world is, and development here to justify our passage to a happier existence beyond. So he's described then the supracosmic, the cosmic terrestrial, and the supraterrestrial perspectives. Now, these are the three worldviews, and he's moving towards the final integrated view, which we will be getting to. Let's go forward. These are the three fundamental ways of seeing, each with its mental attitude towards life that can be adopted with regard to our existence. The rest are usually midway stations or else variations or composites which attempt to adapt themselves more freely to the complexity of the problem. For practically, it is impossible for man, taken as a race, whatever a few individuals may succeed in doing, to guide his life permanently or wholly by the leading motive of any of these three attitudes, uniquely to the exclusion of the other's claim upon his nature. A confused amalgam of two or more of them, a conflict or division of his life motives between them, or some attempt at synthesis, is his way of dealing with the various impulses of his complex being and the intuitions of his mind to which they appeal for their sanction. Almost all men normally devote the major part of their energy to the life on earth, to the terrestrial needs, interests, desires, ideals of the individual and the race. It could not be otherwise. For the care of the body, the sufficient development and satisfaction of the vital and the mental being of man, the pursuit of the high individual and large collective ideals which start from the idea of an attainable human perfection or nearer approach to perfection through his normal development are imposed upon us by the very character of our terrestrial being. They are part of its law, its natural impulse and rule, its condition of growth, and without these things, man could not attain to his full manhood. And again, I note that Sri Aurobindo was accustomed to writing in this old way of English usage, which used the masculine as a form to address all of humanity. It feels and pinches differently today. We say ouch when we hear it. So let's overlook it and remember the context and when he was writing this in the, let's say, around 1940. Any view of our being which neglects, unduly belittles, or intolerantly condemns them is therefore, by that very fact, whatever its other truth or merit or utility, or whatever its suitability to individuals of a certain temperament or in a certain stage of spiritual evolution, unfit to be the general and complete rule of human living. Nature takes good care that the race shall not neglect these aims, which are a necessary part of her evolution, for they fall within the method and stages of the divine plan in us, and a vigilance for her first steps and for the maintenance of their mental and material ground is a preoccupation which she cannot allow to go into the background, since these things belong to the foundation and body of her structure. So yes, it is well and proper that we focus much of our energy on the maintenance of the material frame and on progress through physical life. That doesn't mean we need to be out of balance in our progress through it, but we ought not to ignore it in ascetic bareness or in a sense of renunciation, which insists only on the higher virtues and ignores what we consider to be lower. But also, she has implanted in us a sense that there is something in our composition which goes beyond this first terrestrial nature of humanity. For this reason, the race cannot accept or follow for a very long time any view of being which ignores this higher and subtler sense and labors to confine us entirely to a purely terrestrial way of living. So we must attend to our diviner part too. The intuition of a beyond, the idea and feeling of a soul and spirit in us which is other than the mind, life, and body, or is greater, not limited by their formula, returns upon us and ends by resuming possession. The ordinary man satisfies this sense easily enough by devoting to it his exceptional moments or the latter part of his life when age shall have blunted the zest of his earthly nature, or by recognizing it as something behind or above his normal action to which he can more or less imperfectly direct his natural being. The exceptional man turns to the supraterrestrial as the one aim and law of living, and diminishes or mortifies as much as possible his earthly parts in the hope of developing his celestial nature. Be careful here. Seductive, this is not his view. There have been epochs in which the supraterrestrial view has gained a very powerful hold, and there has been a vacillation between an imperfect human living which cannot take its large natural expansion and a sick ascetic longing for the celestial life, which also does not acquire in more than a few its best pure and happy movement. This is a sign of the creation of some false war in the being by the setting up of a standard or a device that ignores the law of evolutionary capacity, or an overstress that misses the reconciling equation which must exist somewhere in a divine dispensation of our nature. So, balance, integration. But finally, there must open in us, as our mental life deepens and subtler knowledge develops, the perception that the terrestrial and the supraterrestrial are not the only terms of our being, are not the only terms of being. There is something which is supracosmic and the highest remote origin of our existence. So not simply the inner worlds which exceed the grip of physical nature, but a transcendent beyond both. This perception is easily associated by spiritual enthusiasm, by the height and ardor of the soul's aspiration, by the philosophic aloofness or the strict logical intolerance of our intellect, by the eagerness of our will, or by a sick disgust in our vital being, discouraged by the difficulties or disappointed by the results of life, by any or all of these motive forces, with a sense of the entire vanity and unreality of all else than this remote supreme, the vanity of human life, the unreality of cosmic existence, the bitter ugliness and cruelty of earth, the insufficiency of heaven, the aimlessness of the repetition of births in the body. Here again, the ordinary man cannot really live with these ideas. They can only give at most a grayness and restless dissatisfaction to the life in which he must still continue. But the exceptional man abandons all to follow the truth he has seen, and for him they can be the needed food of his spiritual impulse or a stimulus to the one achievement that is now for him the one thing that matters. So, this ascent beyond all this transience into that which exceeds. Periods and countries there have been in which this view of being has become very powerful. A considerable part of the race has swerved aside to the life of the ascetic, not always with a real call to it. The rest adhered to the normal life, but with an underlying belief in its unreality. A belief which can bring about, by too much reiteration and insistence, an unnerving of the life impulse, and an increasing littleness of its motives, or even, by a subtle reaction, an absorption in an ordinary narrow living through a missing of our natural response to the divine being's larger joy in cosmic existence, and a failure of the great progressive human idealism by which we are spurred to a collective self-development and a noble embrace of the battle and the labor. Here again, there is a sign of some insufficiency in the statement of the supracosmic reality, perhaps an overstatement or a mistaken opposition, a missing of the divine equation of the total sense of creation and the entire will of the Creator. A wonderful peroration, and we will put our bookmarks there and finish the chapter next week when he presents to us a grand solution to all this. I thought to illustrate these two views, at least in part, we pull a couple of passages from Savitri to do duty for us. This first would illustrate the focus on the terrestrial. This is from Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 4, The Kingdoms of the Little Life. An animal in the instinctive herd, pushed by life impulses, forced by common needs, each in his own kind saw his ego's glass. All served the aim and action of the pack. Those like himself, by blood or custom kin, to him were parts of his life, his adjunct selves, his personal nebula's constituent stars, satellite companions of his solar eye. A master of his life's environment, a leader of a huddled human mass, herding for safety on a dangerous earth, he gathered them round him as if minor powers to make a common front against the world, or weak and soul on an indifferent earth, as a fortress for his undefended heart, or else to heal his body's loneliness. In others than his kind, he sensed a foe, an alien, unlike force to shun and fear, a stranger and adversary to hate and slay. Or he lived as lives the solitary brute. At war with all, he bore his single fate. Absorbed in the present act, the fleeting days, none thought to look beyond the hour's gains, or dreamed to make this earth a fairer world, or felt some touch divine surprise his heart. The gladness that the fugitive moment gave, the desire grasped, the bliss, the experience won, movement and speed and strength were joy enough, and bodily longings shared, and quarrel and play, and tears and laughter, and the need called love. In war and clasp, these life wants joined the all life, wrestlings of a divided unity, inflicting mutual grief and happiness in ignorance of the self forever one. And then something to suggest. The supra-terrestrial life. This is from Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 6, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Life. There is no end, or none can yet be seen. Although defeated, life must struggle on. Always she sees a crown she cannot grasp. Her eyes are fixed beyond her fallen state. There quivers still within her breast and ours a glory that was once and is no more. Or there calls to us from some unfulfilled beyond a greatness yet unreached by the halting world. In a memory behind our mortal sense, a dream persists of larger, happier air, breathing around free hearts of joy and love, forgotten by us, immortal in lost time. A ghost of bliss pursues her haunted depths, for she remembers still, though now so far, her realm of golden ease and glad desire, and the beauty and strength and happiness that were hers in the sweetness of her glowing paradise. In her kingdom of immortal ecstasy, halfway between God's silence and the abyss. This knowledge in our hidden parts we keep. Awake to a vague mystery's appeal, we meet a deep unseen reality, far truer than the world's face of present truth. We are chased by a self we cannot now recall, and moved by a spirit we must still become. As one who has lost the kingdom of his soul, we look back to some God phase of our birth, other than this imperfect creature here, and hope in this or a diviner world to recover yet from heaven's patient guard what, by our mind's forgetfulness, we miss. Our being's natural felicity, our heart's delight we have exchanged for grief, the body's thrill we bartered for mere pain, the bliss for which our mortal nature yearns, as yearns an obscure moth to blazing light. Our life is a march to a victory never won. A greater word from Sri Aurobindo yet to come. But this for this evening. Thanks for being with us. Namaste. Jai Ma.